There are people that listen to my show that know more about me than they know about their family members. They've listened to me more than they've listened to some of their really good friends. And so it creates these interesting dynamics.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Podcraft, one of the longest running how to podcast series on the planet. I'm Colin Gray from thepodcasthost.com. And in this season, we're talking to some of the best independent podcasters in the business. Last time around, we heard about the goals, the aims, the ambitions of our creators in those early days, as well as how they've evolved. But now it's time to dig into one of the most rewarding aspects of consistency, and that's the sheer traction you get from having a decent back catalogue for new listeners to binge through. But let's not walk before we can run. Our podcasters still had more than a few challenges to overcome to get where they are today. Here's Vicky from Bring Your Product Idea to Life talking about her own struggles.
I mean, first there was the whole, you know, I've never been a podcaster. I don't know anything about podcasts. I don't know anything about tech, you know, all of those things. Just the kind of, there was a bit of fear, if I'm being really honest, about just talking into a microphone and knowing that people going to listen to it. You know, you get the imposter syndrome, why would anyone want to listen to my podcast? Despite the fact that at the time, as I say, I feel like my podcast was one of the only ones doing what I was doing, I still was like, why would anyone want to listen to me? The tech side was tricky. I didn't really know how, you know, all of the things like, what do I need to buy? How do I get a podcast onto Spotify or Apple Podcasts and all of those things? That was also a challenge. I was definitely looking for a lot of guests and it was hard to get guests. Once I'd gone through the initial, you know, I mentioned that I had people that I knew that I thought would make good guests. But once I'd exhausted those, as a new podcaster, it was actually quite hard to approach people and say, "Hey, I've got a podcast. Do you want to come on it?" when you've only done 10 episodes or something, because there's not really much for people to go on. You haven't got much reputation. They don't know if the podcast is going to disappear in a couple of weeks. So that was a bit of a challenge. And how I overcame that, if that's useful, is just by asking. So I did a lot of proactive outreach to people and said, "Hey, I really like what you're doing. I've got this podcast. Would you like to come on? This is what it's about." And of course, not everyone said yes, but some people did. And now it's actually flipped to the point where I get people asking me if they can come on the podcast, and often more people than I can, you know, than can come on. So I think the reason I've got to that place now is because it was a lot of hard work originally. Don't get me wrong, it's still hard work, but I think you refine and you learn and things do get easier over time. You get processes. And also, I feel like the longer you've been podcasting, the kind of more credibility you've built up, because when you're looking for guests, for example, they can see, okay, you've been doing this for however many years, you've done however many episodes, and it just gives them a bit of reassurance that this is something that's going to be worth their time. Because I do appreciate that coming on someone's podcast and talking to them, you know, you are asking them to give something up, and I think they have to feel that it's worth it.
Vicky mentioned the tech side of things, and that's always been one of the biggest barriers facing new podcasters. So how did she push on past that?
I actually did an introduction to podcasting course in the end, because over time, the longer sort of I've been running my business, I'm a big believer in, rather than spending hours trying to figure something out myself, I would rather pay for someone to tell me how to do it and kind of spend the money but save the time. And basically at the end of that, I left with a checklist of things to go and do to get the podcast live. And what surprised me actually was, once someone lays it out for you like that, it isn't actually that hard to get started in podcasting. I think it's the same with creating a product or doing anything, is you just need to know what steps you need to take in which order. And once you've got that, life is a lot simpler.
Let's hear from Paul Thornton from the Joy of Cruising podcast. As the author of 3 books, Paul felt well prepared to navigate many of the initial challenges of podcasting, but he admits that the tech was one of the trickier barriers in those early days.
Yeah, it was kind of a steep learning curve. You know, I watched some YouTube videos, but for the most part, it was kind of trial and error. You know, particularly editing, marketing. I'm pretty good at marketing, mainly, first of all, you know, I've had 5 years of marketing my books. They were all independently published books, so I didn't have, you know, a big firm handling marketing, so I was familiar somewhat with marketing. I have come to learn that there's a lot of free information on the internet, particularly on Facebook, and a lot of it's bad, and there's a lot of scams out there. But yeah, those were the initial roadblocks, you know, just the act of podcasting and the act of editing. And marketing was somewhat of a challenge, only in that I was marketing something I wasn't used to, which is marketing a podcast versus marketing books.
Murr Lafferty of I Should Be Writing isn't just one of the longest serving podcasters in this show. She's also one of the longest serving podcasters in the history of the medium. And as you can no doubt imagine, she had some tech-based challenges to overcome all those years ago.
Oh boy. Well, Apple did not acknowledge podcasting until 2005. And I remember, I think it was 2015, they were doing like the 10-year anniversary of podcasting, and we're like, yeah, it's 11 because it started in 2004. It wasn't until like July of 05 that iTunes got on board. There were very few what we called podcatchers. Do they still call them that? I'm not sure. But, you know, the subscription software that you can subscribe to with RSS and get the podcasts. I understand language evolves, but at the time, podcast meant a file that you subscribed to. So you could do a PDF podcast. You could do a video podcast without YouTube. And I know now it's evolved into something else, and I'm trying real hard to accept it. But I didn't know how to shop for mics. I ended up buying used mics from some podcasters I knew who were also radio guys, so they had good equipment, but they were upgrading theirs, so I bought theirs. But using Audacity to edit and wanted to learn GarageBand, I thought it would be a better tool, but I don't know what it has become in the last 20 years, but I couldn't get my brain around working with GarageBand and podcasts, so that did not last long. So yeah, it was a lot of trying to figure out how to make this new thing work when nobody was supporting it except for the occasional podcatching software.
Back at the start of the episode, we heard Gabe from the Board Game Design Lab talking about the rewarding nature of podcasting. But what about his own challenges and struggles?
Yeah, so I mean, living in Honduras, internet is weird. You know, it's up and down, it's in and out. And so that was always fun. And just, you know, luckily I interviewed very understanding, very gracious guests that when the internet would drop out, which wasn't all the time, but when it did happen, when the power would go out, because we would have brownouts and blackouts. And, you know, anytime you're living in a less stable country, you might say, you're going to have some challenges, technical issues. You know, I was in a situation where if my mic breaks, there is no other microphone. Like, I have to wait 3 months to go back to the States. You know, like, and so constantly trying to figure out backup plans and figure out the worst case scenarios, because there is no Amazon 2-day shipping in Honduras, you know? So that was fun. Just figuring it out though, and learning how to build a community, learning how to kind of build up a business. Again, it wasn't a planned thing. And so trying to kind of retroactively go, oh, okay, so if I'm going to do this and it's actually going to make money, well, what does that look like? And how do you utilize these different things? And do I do ads and sponsorships? And do I make products? And, you know, a couple of years into the podcast, I created the Facebook community, which now has almost 17,000 people. And so that was a challenge of like figuring that out and how to moderate in a way that is effective, but at the same time lets people speak. You know, it's not like, hey, you have to speak in this very small box and it's only based on my political views. Everyone has to believe what I believe. And if you don't, you're out of here. Because that's what a lot of groups turn into. And so trying to moderate in a way that was fair to people, no matter what their, you know, ideology or belief system was. Because like at the end of the day, it's like, we're here to talk about games, guys. Like, this is not a political space. This is not a place for me to get on my soapbox and tell you what to believe. This is a place for us to get better at designing and publishing games. And so trying to maintain that, you know, in spite of how many people pull on you. Because everybody wants you to do it the way they think you should. You know, they haven't built anything. They haven't really created anything and made anything themselves. But they know a whole lot about how you should do your thing, which is always fun. And so just managing that and getting rid of people when they need to maybe go somewhere else and become a manager at another business is what a friend of mine used to say. He's like, we're not firing them. We're helping them go become a manager somewhere else.
So. Here's Susan from the Lush Life podcast.
Well, people actually knowing what a podcast was. I mean, I'd go back and say, hi, I'd like to... I remember one in particular. I was like, yes, I'm here to record. And she said, well, where what room do you want to do it in? You know, where do you want to do it? And I said, well, just a quiet room. But does it look good enough? I was like, well, you know, it's only sound. And she looked at me like, what? I said, it's a podcast. What is that again? So it was really... You know, that was, I don't want to say educating everyone because a lot of people did know what podcasts were, but a few people I worked with at the beginning weren't really sure what it was, what they were going to do with it. Was it, you know, an interesting medium for their clients or to do? But on the other side of that, every bartender, I love the bartending community. I love the drinking community. It's just so generous and giving. I love it. I love it. I can't tell people enough people to get into it. Wish everyone was in it because it's a great, great community. That I would interview someone who is, you know, top. And they would say, oh, well, you have to interview these people. Let me call you. Let me call them for you. Let me get their email address. You have to. And really, it just organically grew. I think the first year I did like 40 some. I did it every week, and it was like 46 weeks out of the 52 weeks that I had a podcast episode up. So that I was just embraced completely. So I know that's not a roadblock, but I guess it was kind of teaching people really what a podcast was. Because if you think, you know, the 8 years it's been, you know, it doesn't seem that long to me that from not knowing what a podcast is to everyone having a podcast.
So I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And if you're keen to try doing this yourself, creating your own podcast, we created a tool called Alitu many years back now, designed to make it as easy as humanly possible to make a podcast. It's got call recording in there. You can record solo. And then it automates a lot of the technical stuff. You get all of your audio cleaned up to make it sound sweet. And you get your theme music and your transitions added in automatically. Plus, the editor allows you to edit your audio in the easiest way possible, podcast specific. And it's got text-based editing in there too. So you can edit as if you're editing a Word document. Then finally, hosting. You can publish your podcast to the world right inside Alitu using our own hosting, or you can connect to many of the most popular podcast hosts out there. So it just makes it super easy to go right from recording to editing to publishing all in one place. That's what Alitu is designed to do, to save you tons of time and a good bit of money, bringing everything into one place. So if you want to try it out, go over to alitu.com. That's Alitu.com, and you can use the free trial to see if it works for you. And though tech-based barriers are common in podcasting, not everyone comes in fresh to the medium without a bunch of prior knowledge of gear or software. Darren from the 1% Better Runner podcast works as a musician and an audio content creator, meant he was as clued up in this stuff as anyone's ever likely to be. But that doesn't mean there weren't still some things he wished he'd known right back at the beginning.
I wish I would have known what the reason was for it to be alive, the podcast, the content, and then serve and how it can serve people. I wish I would have really refined my why it existed, is what I call it. When I work with clients, I go, why should your podcast exist? And I got that from a podcaster, Allison Chan, here in Sydney. She does more of journalistic narrative scripted podcasting, and she would ask me so much. And I remember she was just like, why does this exist? Why should this exist? And I think it's such a great question. It's like, is it driving enough to make you have to do it and go through all the crap? Whereas I was like, I just want to make cool audio. So that kind of goes back to, you know, it's like, that's enough to kind of get me going, but I don't think it's enough to really find your audience, to do all the things that a long piece of content needs to do. And again, you know, treating it more like brand marketing and promotion, because it really is like branding. And how can this be a business that's sustainable if I want to keep doing it, or is it a side project? So yeah, it was the why should exist, and then how that ties to the brand marketing. And instead of, oh, I've got great sounding microphones and I can do this cool little slick audio trick where we're walking and then it sounds like we're in underwater and then it spins. Like I was so focused on that for the first one to two years that it like just it muddied up a lot of things, and I made some poor decisions business-wise because I was just trying to make the coolest sounding thing versus either what the client wanted or, you know, what my audience wanted. So yeah, great question.
Alana and Samra of the She Well Read podcast now, what do they wish they'd known before they'd started?
Honestly, knowing where to start, I think, was the biggest roadblock. Like, we had all of these ideas and all these thoughts and concepts, but trying to figure out how to put that together was difficult. But I will say what really helped was us going to She Podcast Live in 2019. We went to their initial conference in Atlanta and we learned so much. It was almost like information overload, but in a good way, because it's like we needed to know all of these things. But even then, like, we had to be like, OK, now what do we do with all of this information we just learned? And I'd say more roadblocks is, you know, kind of developing ourselves and like changing as we continue on and trying to, you know, do all the things that other podcasts try to do, like growing your audience, monetization, like the same ABCs, but figuring out how that would work with for us, especially since we work 9-to-5 jobs and this is completely self-funded. So we don't have any, you know, anybody backing us or anything like that. And so, yeah, I'd say those were some of the initial challenges and roadblocks, at least for me. And then what I'd wish that we'd known earlier is that we could do whatever the freak we want with this. Like, we did not, like, in the beginning of our show, like, if you listen to the first couple seasons, which, Samra, I don't know if you've done recently, but
no. I have not done that. Thank you.
It's crazy. But if you listen to those first two seasons, like, they were decent. They were good. It was just like you could tell we were just figuring stuff out. And like we didn't even curse in the beginning because I was like, yeah, remember we didn't curse because I was like, I know it was like, I think we had learned that it's like in some countries, they're not even going to play your show. And I was like, I don't want to limit our reach if we're an explicit show and then other people can't listen.
It was the way then, no one was listening. We really were right about limiting our reach.
Right. When it was like, no, we need to reach first before we can worry about something like that. But just also knowing that being ourselves is what sells this show. And so a part of that was like things like cursing or, you know, kind of letting our shoulders relax a little bit more. I wish we would have done more of that in the beginning for sure.
Yeah, you're speaking for real. I feel like it's just so easy to compare yourself, especially when you're trying to push yourself forward. Of course, you want to look around and see like, okay, where is the bar? But also, you know, it's not about other people running their race at all. Like, if you get too focused on that stuff, I think you end up doing a bunch of stuff that's not productive. And we definitely did a lot of that. And we had to, like, you know, which I'm glad we did take a second, like, between each season to just reevaluate what we're doing and what is working and what didn't work. And, you know, a lot of it was just trying to figure out how to reach our audience and how to connect with them in the best way, like in the way that they respond to. So just realizing that, you know, just because people connect with someone this way, it doesn't necessarily mean like that's what works for your shtick or whatever. So I think that, you know, just typical, like, growing up stuff, I think, in your 20s. It feels very parallel to, like, what I feel like we've learned, or at least what I've learned in my 20s, which is, like, just, you know, everybody's got their own journey. Like, it's not someone's ahead or behind. We're all just, like, figuring it out.
Here's Andrea from the Savvy Social podcast.
I wish I leaned more into the conversational aspect of podcasting because I came from the YouTube world and I started off creating YouTube videos. It's a very interesting structure, and you kind of have to get to the point a lot quicker. So my early podcast episodes felt a little a little more stiff than my podcast episodes now. And if I could go back, I would just relax a little bit on the show. The beauty of podcasts is it feels like, you know, people take me on the go with them. It feels like I'm, you know, a friend in their ear. And that's how I feel about podcasts I listen to. And so I think I would just, you know, relax a little bit. It doesn't have to be so stuffy. It doesn't have to be so, you know, like formulaic. It can feel more like a conversation with a friend. And so I think that would actually help me like build listenership faster because people would feel more connected to me and my show.
Like Andrea, most podcasters won't be 100% happy with their first few episodes. This is completely normal. It takes time to learn the ropes and the medium and really find your voice. But it's a bit of a paradox. You know, we struggle to get those first few episodes together, and then we're desperate for the whole world to hear them. Again, that's totally natural. But there's something to be said about embracing the fact that in those early days, very few people are actually listening to you. It's a great time for development, as opposed to thinking about that explosive growth.
100%. I was so stiff and basically reading a script for those first 20 episodes that I'm glad they don't have a lot of downloads, and that I really was just practicing podcasting at that point. And so it really is like I think it's the difference between watching like little league football and like mainstream football. I don't know why I chose a sports analogy because I'm not really a huge sports person, but hopefully I'll understand what I'm saying. Watching the kids play versus watching like the professionals play. It feels mostly like that when you're first starting out, and you don't really, it's like a different experience, right? So yeah.
Creating and publishing podcast episodes is like doing reps in the gym. The more you do, the better, the stronger, the more confident you get. It's hard work too. It takes time, but if you stick with it for long enough, you'll start to see those small but rewarding signs that you're getting traction. Here's Alana and Samra.
Every year has encouraged us to keep going, no matter if we hit all of our quote unquote milestones that we wanted to hit or not, because I feel like every year there's been something that's like tipping us even closer and closer, closer to like where we're trying to be that keeps us going. I feel like the most constant thing that keeps us going is whenever people reach out to us and are like, oh my gosh, I love your show. It's done this for me. Like most recently, we had a minisode that was posted and somebody DM'd us and was like, oh my gosh, yes. Thank God it's about time. I was waiting. And she was like, you know, just kidding. But like, seriously, I love what you guys are doing, blah, 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 blah. Like that. You know, it doesn't happen every day, obviously, but when it does, like those once in a blue moon moments, or like we get a new review or something like that, or somebody's like, oh my gosh, I love this episode you did with blah, 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 blah. I feel like, and maybe that's a little bit of, not egotistical. There's a word, I can't think of the word, but like, I don't know. It's just motivating to me.
I think so. I mean, look, I'm an affirmations type of girl. So I respond well when people are like, okay, go girl. I'm like, okay, I'm doing something. Really though.
Right. Or somebody will be like, oh my gosh, wait, don't you have, you on TikTok, aren't you? You have a book club. And I'm like, yeah, I do. That clout.
Right. I'm doing it for the clout, actually.
We're doing it for the clout. No, but for real. That really lights us up. Because again, all this hard work, you know, it's podcasting sometimes is a very thankless job, like many things are. So getting that positive feedback and that, you know, we are aligning with what our purpose is and getting that feedback from people, I think definitely keeps us from, or at least keeps me from the thoughts of quitting.
You'll never eliminate all of those barriers and challenges, no matter how long you've been podcasting. Travelin' Chit's Dee Carey has 5 years and well over 250 episodes under her belt, not to mention recognition on the awards scene. And although she creates her podcast, first and foremost because she enjoys it, Dee Carey admits there are times when she wishes she got more feedback from her listeners.
There are the really beautiful moments when someone says something like, oh, I really like that show, or that episode about X, Y, and Z really made me feel better about an occurrence in my own life, but unfortunately, I don't really hear much from my listeners. The call to actions don't really get the type of response that I would enjoy. So I think sometimes when people assume that you have a platform, that you get more interaction or you get more, I guess, commentary than you actually do. And it's not to say that I haven't gotten any commentary from the audiences, but I just don't think it is on the scale that would necessarily be expected. I had a great time a few months ago having just guests, people that listen to the show. I did an open call like, hey, you know, for the people that were on my newsletter, if you'd love to be a guest, if you want to just talk to me about travel, reply. And so I had about four or five people that were like, hey, I'd love to be a guest. And that was a really, really fun conversation that I was able to have with regular people, not travel professionals, not people who do it for a 9-to-5, but people as regular as I am that happen to just enjoy taking a trip here and there. And I feel like that kind of interaction with my listeners is always so meaningful to me because it goes right back to the, you can find out anything by asking the right questions of people. And that for me is really what the joy in the podcast is. So I don't really get people that send emails every week. I mean, I would love to hear from people that listen to the show and I mention it, but I also try not to take it personal because I know that I listen to a ton of shows that I don't interact with.
And getting feedback is something Murr has struggled a bit with in recent years too.
The feedback has slowed down a little bit. Well, not a little bit, a lot. A lot of my feedback comes from people who watch the live stream and send me, you know, ask questions in the live stream and I answer them. But I don't get a lot of feedback via email anymore. And I do ask for it, but I just don't get as much anymore. I don't know if it's because of social media that you can get answers a lot faster from people. I have a Discord and people ask questions in the Discord and they either answer it, you know, it's either the community answers it or I will help out. So I think, I don't know if I'm trying to make myself feel better, this is the truth, but it feels like there are many other ways people can get answers from me that are not my next episode. I try to make myself very accessible to the Discord and there are a lot more writers giving out advice, even if they don't have like a specific podcast. There are writers who update their TikTok every day with writing advice. It's amazing. I don't know how they do it.
It's always really interesting to hear about Murr's podcasting journey because she's tried so many different experiments and formats over the years.
Early on, when I didn't have a publishing deal, I did several novellas and one novel in serialized form. But I did both audio and PDF. And I have done podcasts with co-hosts before. My good friend Matt Wallace and I did Ditch Diggers, which was a writing podcast for more career writers to teach them about various business things. At one point, I just experimented with not releasing via a serialized format week by week, but releasing all the episodes at once. Just one big, not one big file, but several different files, but all at once, just to see what that would do. But I find that people, I think, pretty much prefer the at least one a week type of scheduling. Back in 2007, I did do a video podcast with a good friend of mine called This Day in Alternate History, where we did just joke historical things, but like a news show. And another person we were working with did the video. And that was a lot of fun. So I've done video, PDF, co-host, solo, fiction. Yeah, that's most of what I've done.
Murr touched on serialized content there. And podcasting in seasons can be a great way for creators to stay consistent while also taking regular breaks and avoiding burnout. Here's Kathy from Wild for Scotland.
We started the podcast about 3 years ago. And in year one and year two, I produced 2 seasons each with 10 episodes each. So 40 episodes across 2 years. And that meant we were running for about 10 weeks, 11 weeks, because we usually took a break in the middle, on top of the break in between seasons. And then we would take a few months off. And I would time those breaks usually with intense or busy times in my business. So over the summer is when I travel a lot for work and when I do a lot of collaborations with brands and businesses. And then over the winter is when I work a lot on my content. on the website and also planning itineraries for clients so that we kind of get seasons in the spring and in the autumn, roughly speaking. But then now we're in year three and we actually only produced one season this year in addition to a few sponsored episodes throughout the summer and spring. And the main reason for that really was because I started to feel burnt out and I didn't know how I was going to manage a season in the spring while also doing a lot of other projects. And so again, I spoke with my editor and she said, you know, you're allowed to just decide it's just going to be one season this year and that's okay. Yes, it might disappoint a few people. Yes, you might have a lot of ideas for episodes you won't get to produce, but you wouldn't be able to produce the content the way you want to anyways. Your podcast wouldn't be as good as you want it to be if you do it with pressure and with stress and with anxiety. And I'm so glad I took that decision this year. And we're going to do the same again next year. I know I can't produce two seasons in a year to the quality level that I want them to be. And, you know, it takes a long time to produce the show. So, and a lot of resources as well. So yeah, I just can't produce more than that. So yeah, we do take about 3-4 months, 5 months in between seasons. But then the sponsored episodes we work on with brands and businesses, they run throughout the year. So we produce those kind of one-off episodes more often.
The benefits of podcast seasons aren't all about the podcaster. From a listener's point of view, they can make your content much more digestible too.
Every season we produce has an overarching theme. The first one was islands, the second one was road trips. 3 and 4 were all about the people of Scotland. So we brought an interview element into the show and that was tied to the Year of Scottish Stories, which was the themed, kind of overarching themed cultural year in Scotland at the time. And then the last season we're currently producing is all about water. And so I try to pick themes that I'm personally interested in, but it also give me the freedom to include a variety of different topics and themes and subjects. So it's not just one thing. Islands was maybe the most concise focus we had so far, but it was also the first season and I had to write about experiences from the past. So it was easier then, whereas now I like to broaden it out a little bit. But yes, it means that it's much easier for me to pick and choose which episodes to produce and which stories to tell, rather than just having no theme and going wild. I think it's also nice. It's easier to market, to be quite honest, you know, it makes the marketing message a lot easier. And for listeners as well, it's nice to know that they can, for a couple of months, really immerse themselves in a topic and explore it in from different angles as well.
All right, as we move towards talking about the benefits of building a back catalogue, there's one important thing worth addressing, and that's all around evergreen content. If you create highly time-sensitive content, you're unlikely to see many new listeners binging back through your old back catalogue. But unless you're running a news podcast, you'll likely find that most of your content does stand the test of time. Here's Vicky from Bring Your Product Idea to Life.
So for example, I work with helping people sell their products on Amazon, and things on Amazon do occasionally change. So I might release a new episode about, you know, I might have talked about something and then 18 months later, I think, do you know what? That actually isn't as relevant now. I'm going to do a refresher. The interviews I do, I would say, are really evergreen. Yeah. And actually, and a lot of, most of the content I do, I would say is I wouldn't think that much of it would date.
As podcasters, our main focus is usually on our next episode, you know, that next bit of content. And we can almost forget about the many great episodes we've worked so hard on in the past. I mean, that's pretty natural because they're all published and they're out there. They don't need any more of our time or attention. But past episodes aren't like old social media posts that quickly vanish into the ether. They're a massive part of what allow new listeners to spend time with your podcast and to really buy into your content, your message, and, well, just you.
The amount of people who go through our archive and listen to old episodes is incredible to see, even when we don't produce a new episode and in the months where no new content is coming out. It's quite nice to see that the downloads are staying pretty consistent with the rest of the year when new episodes are coming out, which is amazing because it means that all those episodes are still there, are still being listened to, they still reach new audiences. And that's, from a marketing perspective, a huge return on investment because it isn't just the episode is being buried under, you know, like an Instagram post that is buried under new content and no one goes back in the feed to look at old stuff. And it's just not like that with podcasting. And it's amazing to see that and being able to show, you know, the stats prove people actually want to do and want to listen to that content forever, really.
Gabe, Board Game Design Lab.
Finding ways to reutilize the back catalog, right? To realize that a lot of people haven't heard all the stuff. And even though it's something that as a podcaster, I might think, oh, I've already done that. I've already had that conversation, whatever. Well, repurpose it, reuse it. You know, even though it was 4 years ago, the content is still valuable and it's maybe even more valuable. And so that's one thing I'm working on now is figuring out how can I not just continue to create new conversations, new everything. It's like, no. Let's utilize this incredible resource. And then, because it's not only a little bit easier for me where I'm not having to constantly do new stuff, but it's also good for listeners. It's good for new listeners who haven't heard that. They're like, oh, this is amazing. It's also good for old listeners that just maybe need to be reminded. You know, that conversation holds up today like it did 4 years ago, but they haven't heard it in 4 years either, you know, and so put it back out there and let them get some benefit as well.
Gabe makes a great point here, doesn't he? That your back catalog is more than just something for new listeners to binge. It's also a great resource for repurposing and creating entirely new content. As Gabe hikes on towards an incredible 500 episodes, he's built a massive back catalog that might even be beyond the binging capabilities of even an avid listener. So let's dig into a little more and find out what he plans to do with all that content.
So recently I ran a crowdfunding campaign for the next year's content to say, hey, here's where I'm going. You know, I put together another year, basically 52 podcasts. But is that what you want? Talking to my community. And again, this is 21,000-ish people across all platforms, across the email list, across the Facebook community, across, you know, people just that are listeners. And I said, hey, what do you want? And I had a feeling that a whole bunch more podcast episodes was not it. And so going in, I was like, I don't think this is going to be successful. I was talking to my wife. I was talking to some friends, you know, that are aware of all these things. I was like, I don't think this is going to work. I think I'm going to have to pivot and do something different. And sure enough, that was the case where less than 1% of that 21,000 was interested in supporting the show, even with $1. Right. And I was sitting there thinking about that. I was like, saturation is such a weird word, especially in these terms, but there is no shortage of content on the internet, especially in my space, you know, in the game design world, there's a lot. And I've created not most of it, but a lot of it, right? Maybe not 51%, but, you know, 30, a lot based on the website and all the resources that are there, the show, the YouTube channel, like there is so much out there and it's free. And if you're willing to search a little bit, you can probably find what you need. And so do I need to do a whole bunch of other episodes? I've basically hit every topic that I was interested in. You know, the list of topics that I'm super excited about is dwindling rapidly at this point. And so it's like, well, what does it look like to do something different? And so going into next year, another thing real quick, I did a survey of the audience before the crowdfunding campaign. I did a survey and asked all of these questions. And one of the questions on there was, who would you like me to interview? Like going into next year, who do you want me to interview? And the vast majority of names that people gave me were people I'd already interviewed or people that don't speak English. It's like, huh. And that tells me that there's a whole bunch of people in the audience that just hasn't gotten through the 330 plus episodes of the show. And so going into next year, my plan is to, for the podcast, there's still going to be an episode every week. And I'll do some new episodes here and there. And there's a handful of people I really want to chat with that just haven't, you know, hasn't worked out to have an interview yet. So, you know, get them on the show. A couple topics I really want to dive into still. But most of the year, most weeks of the year, I'm just going to take an older episode that I think is like a greatest hit. It's like, oh, that was one of the best ones. That was one of the best conversations. That was one of the coolest, most amazing designers, amazing publishers. And I'm going to repackage it just a little bit and re-release it. And so 2024 is going to be 52 episodes of like the best content. One, to make it easy to find, right? If you're a new listener, hey, this is the year for you. Here's all the best stuff. And if you're a listener that's been around since the beginning, well, it probably doesn't hurt to listen to those episodes again. Again, this is evergreen content. And you haven't heard that episode in 5 years. So it's not like you remember what was said, right? This is all, it's going to be new to you just because, you know, our brains aren't very good at holding information. Our brains are great at having ideas, not keeping ideas, not holding them in there. And so I think it works for everybody. It's a little bit less work intensive for me because, again, I'm just repackaging. I'm not having to spend a lot of time. And I can now refocus and pivot a little bit. And so my plan is to, what's the old saying? It's like, do for one person what you wish you could do for everybody. And so I'm going to be more focused on individuals, helping individual designers who are serious, who want to create great games, bring them to life, get them on the market, publish, you know, make money off of this thing, like figure out how to go pro, so to speak. I'm going to focus on that. And that's going to help me make content. I'm going to lean more into YouTube. But again, now I'm you know, the podcast is audio and it's on YouTube. So kind of making it searchable there. And hopefully it's going to expand. That's one thing I've noticed as far as you're asking earlier about promotion and expanding the audience. I didn't necessarily mean for this to happen, but it worked out. Is the community has picked up so many people from the YouTube channel that would have never found the podcast or don't listen to podcasts. They're YouTube folks, right? They're not really podcast listeners. You know, maybe they don't have a commute to work, but they're sitting there in their office, you know, at home all day long or whatever. And so the YouTube channel has actually brought in a lot more people to the community. So focusing on that, leaning into that, figuring out video. Also, it's a new adventure, right? I haven't done a lot of that. Again, there's a whole nother technical side of things I have to figure out, a whole nother software thing I have to figure out, a whole nother understanding of lighting and sound and memes. And like, there's so many things that you have to figure out to make good YouTube videos. So that excites me. So not only do I think it's a better business move, but also from a personal standpoint, it's a new adventure. Will it work out? I don't know. I can come back and report back later, but I'm feeling good about it.
Here's Vicky talking about her own repurposing plans.
Turning all the back catalog into blog posts, that'll be one thing as a way of re-promoting them, resharing some older episodes, you know, especially if there's a theme or a link to an old episode, if that makes sense. If there's a, so for example, I did record an episode about preparing for Christmas in June or July, and I've re-released that episode. I think I've only re-released it once, but I re-released it the following June or July, whatever it was, because that was quite timely. And I do occasionally repurpose episodes like that. But yeah, this year, something I definitely want to do is a bit more of the back catalogue, because I've got this big back catalogue. I think if you're new and you're coming to a podcast, I guess the thing that I'm trying to figure out is if you were coming to my podcast as a new listener and you went, oh my gosh, there's hundreds of episodes, which ones would be a good starting point and how would you know that? So that's something I'm thinking through at the moment. For people who maybe want to get a sense about me or how I work or are interested in specific topics, what a good place is for them to start.
At the time of recording, Andrea was planning for her 300th episode, which is yet another massive back catalogue in her ranks. Let's find out her thoughts on reusing and repurposing old content.
I used to take the episodes, get them transcribed, and give them to a copywriter to turn into blog posts. But my blog never really got much traffic. Perhaps I needed to do more search engine optimization there. I always found the podcast episodes themselves did better. So instead, we just embed the transcripts now as a blog post. I repurpose everything from the podcast into social posts. So, and this is what we do for my clients at the agency as well. So I don't have to create all of my own social content. So it can turn into, you know, a thought leadership post on LinkedIn. It can be a carousel post on Instagram. We can pull clips and put them on TikTok. And so pretty much everything, it feeds into everything else that I do in my marketing. So that's how we repurpose the podcast. And I would say as far as publishing episodes themselves, we tried that 1 year because over the holidays, it tends to be very slow, like the December holidays. So I don't release new episodes then. We 1 year we did like a from the archives kind of repost. They didn't do very well. So what we do now is episodes where I was interviewed on another podcast. We'll take those and put them in my feed. So places where I was a guest expert, I guess, on someone else's podcast, put that on my feed. And that has worked really well because it's not often that my listeners get to hear me being interviewed. And so that's what we do now over the December holidays. So it's another way to repurpose content, but it's not really my own podcast.
We're going to have a full episode dedicated to our podcasters' monetization experiences, all their tips and advice. That'll be later on in the season. But here's an interesting approach from Mer when it comes to utilizing her back catalog.
The entirety of the show is not available via the podcast network. I usually only have 50 shows in the RSS feed because if you have over 600 shows in your RSS feed, it's going to be a large behemoth. So I automatically always have the last one drop off when a new one comes up. And when I started my Patreon almost 10 years ago, I decided to make my entire archive as one of the rewards. So it's like its lowest tier. You don't have to give me much, but you can get the entire backlog.
Well, we've learned a lot in this episode, haven't we? Firstly, there's a lot of challenges and barriers to becoming a successful indie podcaster with hundreds of episodes under your belt. There's also the fact that obstacles and struggles don't necessarily disappear altogether once you reach a certain stage. That said, hopefully, you're also clearer that there's nothing so scary or insurmountable that you can't get past it with the right mindset, the right tools, and a good workflow. We also learned about the amazing potential of a really chunky, value-packed, and evergreen back catalogue. You know, there's a critical mass of published episodes where each new listener you pick up goes on an obsessive binge of your content. By the end of that, you've gained another superfan. Podcasting's a brilliant medium for building these deep relationships too, and there's so many opportunities that span from them. On that positive note, let's close with another inspiring reflection from Gabe.
It's kind of cool now, though. People who listen to your show then start a podcast, and then they want to like invite you on for an interview, and it's like, oh, this is like it's coming full circle. You know, that's been fun to kind of see people go out and be successful and do really well, and for them to send me a message or an email or something and say, hey, really appreciate your show or you know your content. It helped me get to where I am now. Right. And it's just cool. It's been, you know, now that I've done this for a while, I've been able to see people's trajectory. I've been able to see them come in and, you know, as a first time designer, first time question, you know, whatever in the community, and they ask something and then, you know, 3 years later, they make $1 million on Kickstarter. Right. And you're like, oh, dang, that's like so cool to see somebody's path to get there and to be part of it. It's one of the most fulfilling aspects about all of this.
You've been listening to Podcraft, brought to you by thepodcasthost.com. If you're looking to start your own show, go over to thepodcasthost.com/start, and it takes you through everything you need. On the next episode, we'll build on what we've learned today by digging into the nuts and bolts of what it takes to stay consistent, from timeframes to workflows to content stacking, and even building a team around your show. Our IndiePod legends have no shortage of anecdotes, tips, and advice for you on these fronts, so make sure you're subscribed or following on your listening app of choice so that the episode is delivered to you automatically the minute it's published. And on a final note around that, if you're looking to start your podcast, check out our book, Finally Start Your Podcast. It's got everything you need to launch your show right from the planning stage through to publishing your first episode, including advice on workflow and consistency. Go on over to thepodcasthost.com/finally to grab a copy.